If you were a housewife back in March of 1938, or if you drove a taxi cab, or ran a gas station, or were an artist, a seamstress, an off-duty policeman, or just a youngster home from school with a cold, and if you listened to the radio, and who didn't in those days, you might have heard this.
Well, sir, it's late afternoon as we enter the small house halfway up on the next block down. And here in the kitchen, we find Mr. Victor Gook and his son, Mr. Rush Gook. Mr. Victor Gook has drawn the kitchen table over by the sink where the light's the best, and he's doing a spot of office work at home. And Mr. Rush Gook, who just this moment arrived from school, removes his cap and overcoat. Listen.
Not through there, guy?
I am through with the actual labor. All I have to do now is copy some figures neatly on a sheet of paper.
It's all right if I talk then, huh?
You go ahead.
Mom's not upstairs?
Mom's next door, chewing the fat with Ma Donahue. What's on your mind?
I've been doing considerable thinking about the party we're going to have a week from Saturday.
Reach me my eraser. I dropped it on the floor.
That party was taken right out of my hands, you know.
So I understand.
Here.
Thanks.
Mom started out by making me official host. The party was to be in honor of Nicer Scott, and I was going to be in charge of all arrangements. But she figured too many people would have to be invited, so she decided to leave out the kids. And took over the arrangements herself.
You see the good sense of that, don't you? We can't get the population of the United States in this modest dwelling.
No, just the same.
What exactly is your beef?
If I could be reinstated as official host, I'd put on a party you'd hear about.
You have my sympathy, crab meat, but I don't see what I can do about the matter.
Well, I was thinking maybe you could persuade Mom.
To reinstate you as official host?
Yeah.
It's hardly in my department.
You'll be present at the party a week from next Saturday. You'll want to have a bang-up time, won't you?
Sure.
The plans I got worked out would guarantee you a bang-up time.
That's so?
You'd have so much enjoyment you'd never forget it.
Tell Papa.
All afternoon I've been running stuff through my head.
You went to school this afternoon, didn't you?
Yeah, but I never paid much attention in class. My mind was busy on sensational arrangements for this party. I got stunts worked out people will talk about for the next 50 years.
Sounds like you plan a social function of a rather ambitious nature.
I do.
Reach me my eraser again, will you? I seem to be all butterfingers today.
You know what the party will be like if Mom gives it, don't you?
No, what?
It'll be... Here's your eraser.
Thanks.
Dull.
The party will be dull under your mother's management?
Well, maybe dull is a harsh word.
Maybe it is.
Maybe ordinary is better. The people will come here. They'll hang their hat and coat in the hall. They'll all go in the living room and sit down. They'll talk back and forth. After a while, Mom will whip out ice cream and cake. They'll talk a while longer. Pretty soon they say goodnight and go home. Party's all over.
That setup don't appeal to you, huh?
No. It's like everybody else's party. There's nothing different about it.
Let's hear some of your ideas.
Can I expect cooperation from you if I confide in you?
Cooperation?
Will you try to persuade Mom I ought to be reinstated as official host?
Well, frankly, Margaret, I don't think I could throw much weight. Your mother's decisions on matters like this are generally pretty cut and dried.
Well, you could try. You could come whooping in all excited and slap her on the back and say, "By golly, Sade, that Rush sure has rung the bell. He's got stunts lined up for this party a week from Saturday that'll make you jump over the People's Bank building." The basketball cheerleader, Nate Crabtree, wrote a sentence on the blackboard at a pep meeting we had last week. Sentence was, "Enthusiasm is contagious."
Enthusiasm is contagious?
Enthusiasm is contagious. And that's supposed to be true. Look, pretty soon Mom will be home. Suppose when she opens the door, you jump out of your chair like a skyrocket and say, "By gosh, kiddo, that doggone Rush has got stunts doctored up for this party a week from Saturday that'll make you swallow your shoes." Enthusiasm is contagious. Work it right and you'll have Mom reinstating me as official host in 40 seconds.
Well, what are some of these stunts of yours?
Got them right here in my pocket, wrote down on a piece of paper.
In the past, Melon Seed, I've noticed you're apt to show a tendency to lean towards impractical extremes. I approve of the happy fires of youth and all that, but I've reached a conservative age.
Listen to these.
Okay.
Two physicians and three trained nurses in constant attendance.
How's that?
If I'm reinstated as official host of the party, I'm going to have a platform in the front hallway. On this platform will be five chairs. In the chairs will be seated two doctors and three nurses, all dressed in white.
What's the idea?
Suppose somebody gets sick at the party.
Why should anybody get sick?
Well, some might eat too much ice cream. Others might get exhausted laughing at the jolly jokes. You can't ever tell. People are human beings and liable to get sick any minute of the day or night.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, it gives class to a party. Innocent bystanders downtown will be saying, "Hey, Walter, hear about the big social function they had on Virginia Avenue. Two doctors and three nurses was hired to keep eye on the guests."
Hmm.
There'll be a piece in the newspaper. One of the most stylish events of the whole pleasure-crazed social season was given last night by Mr. Rush Cook of Virginia Avenue. Among those present was... and so forth and so on.
Got any more fancy features?
Got plenty. For one thing, I'm going to call the fire department.
You don't contemplate livening up the party by setting the house on fire?
Oh, no.
I was somewhat apprehensive. I love to see people have fun at my home, but I draw the line...
Here's the angle. Along about 9:30 in the evening, party's kind of sag. Appreciate the angle I'm attempting to put across. Different guests start yawning, and the official host begins to get desperate. He wonders, what the heck could I better do to put some pep in things? Well, I got that problem solved. I'm going to telephone the fire department.
False alarm?
Sure. Everybody enjoys watching fire wagons. And these fire wagons will stop right in front of our house. Great sport for everybody.
I have a discouraging note.
Yeah?
There's a severe penalty for turning in false alarms.
Is there?
10 years in jail or something. You can see for yourself that while the fire engines are coming here on a false alarm, a real fire might break out somewhere and make it disagreeable all around.
Yeah. Well, guess I better cross that one off my list.
It might be the best thing. What's your next stint?
There'll be a policeman in uniform at the party. He'll walk around among the people all during the evening and sort of keep an eye on things.
You're afraid our guest will steal the puss spoon?
No.
What are you afraid they'll steal?
Nothing. The policeman will just be an ornament. He'll add tone to the party. Keep order and see that nobody makes a disturbance.
Very fashionable.
Ain't it, though?
I imagine the people we invite to the party will be greatly flattered.
Sure.
Of course, I hope your policeman don't find it necessary to hit any of our friends over the head with his billy club.
Oh, he won't do anything like that. He'll just mingle with the crowd. Of course, if groups start ganging up in doorways and stuff, he'll come along and holler, break it up, in a friendly sort of way.
Hmm.
That ought to get printed in the newspaper, too. Among the stylish features at Mr. Rush Cook's big social event Saturday night was the presence of a police officer who prevented riots and various other crimes.
Hmm.
Hot stuff?
Yeah. Tell me more of your plans.
All right. Here's the big super special stunt. Everybody's going to get tattooed with my compliments.
Tattooed?
Yeah. There's a tattoo fella that's just started up business down on West Evans Street. I'm going to hire him to come out here the night of the party and tattoo all the various guests.
You going to tattoo pictures on him?
No, words. In memory of the finest social event I ever attended, Mr. Rushcook's party, March 12th, 1938.
Hmm.
How you like that?
It's certainly different.
Another idea of mine is to have 35...
I believe that's all I got time for now, Harriet.
Going someplace?
Yeah. Got these figures all copied. Think I'll stroll down to the office with him.
Well, will you work on mine?
Sure.
Persuade her I ought to be reinstated as official host at the party.
Okay.
You can say for yourself, I'll really put on a social function if I get the chance.
No doubt about it. What you gonna do now?
Telephone Rooster Davis. He'll be greatly interested in my various stunts.
Hmm.
467-HA, please. Correct. I can trust you, can't I?
How do you mean?
Not to be telling my plans around town.
Oh, sure.
I'm going to bind Rooster to secrecy.
I won't breathe it to a soul. Well, your mother gets home before I do. Tell her I've gone.
Okay.
So long.
So long. Hello, Rooster.
This is Gary Owens. Back in the days when radio was king, there was one daytime radio program standing so far above those around it that it provoked such an intense admiration among its fans that it still dominates some of their lives today, almost 30 years after it left the air. One of those so affected is Jack Foster, who took his tape recorder and drove some 10,000 miles collecting recollections of the stars of Vic and Sade. This program is the result of that expedition. We wish to thank those who participated for giving their time, and Mary Frances Reimer, widow of Paul Reimer, who was the author of Vic and Sade, for her help. Mrs. Reimer is editor of a volume of Vic and Sade's scripts called The Small House Halfway Up in the Next Block. Now here is Bob Arbogast to take us on a little trip to The Small House Halfway Up in the Next Block.
Vic and Sade was a daytime radio program created by Paul Reimer that was on the air from June of 1932 until September 29th, 1944. It was not like any other radio program ever. This is a tribute to Vic and Sade. It's late 1972 as we visit the small town halfway up in the next state now. The mistress of the menage is seated at the kitchen table, relaxing over a cup of coffee and reminiscing about the days when she played the part of Sade in Paul Reimer's remarkable radio program of the 30s and 40s. Let's listen.
Unfortunately, the bulk of the audience had to be women because of the times the program was heard. Artists and then people in the theater were great fans. The engineers. You heard much more about it right around the studios from the men than you did the women. I remember we would hear from judges. There was one judge in New York State, and he would get off the bench and recess the court and go into his chambers to listen to Vic and Sade. I think it's true. I think if it had been on for any length of time at night, the men would be the ones who would be more vocal about it than women. Women would delight in it, but they wouldn't say, "Oh, I remember well." You know, when that happened at our house.
That was the voice of Bernadine Flynn as she sounds today. We're taking a conversational tour of reminiscences of Vic and Sade in an attempt to recapture for fans of the old radio show something of the flavor of Vic and Sade, and of the personalities who together made Vic and Sade the wonderful, unique thing that it was. The Vic and Sade theme that we heard a moment ago is the way Clarence Hartzell plays it on the organ. Here's the way he remembers Uncle Fletcher.
You remember Miss Gilfop there in Dixon and her married daughter Fern, don't you, Sadie? Well, Miss Gilfop was the Dixon girl that had the brother to fall off in a five-story building and still live there years ago. Had a brother. Her brother's name was Richard. Yin-Yang Britcher. He recovered from falling off that building, moved to Fresno, Colorado, married a woman within 3 days of being 22 years old, went into the dead or alive horse and mule business, and later died. Now, here's another picture, Sadie. You'll never guess who this is. Emmett Chowning. The reason I say you'd never guess who he is, because he only stayed in this part of the country 5 minutes and then went back to the state of New Mexico, where he came from. Emmett Chowning left the state of New Mexico and come to Dixon, Illinois, because some relatives had promised him a job. He got off the train, got homesick, began to cry, climbed back on the half-wit train, went to Davenport, Iowa, changed cars at that community, and headed back for New Mexico. Only 5 minutes he lingered in Dixon. Me and this relative of his were the only ones that even saw him. All the way across the country from New Mexico, Emmett Chowning was happy as a horse. He was going to Dixon to take over a good job. But he no sooner got off the train than homesickness set in. He sobbed like a baby. Conductor hollered, "All aboard!" And Emmett Chowning climbed back on the train, lingered in Dixon 5 minutes, and only 5 minutes. Teaches us a lesson, don't it?
Bill Idelson, who played the part of the boy Rush, is now a writer and television producer on the West Coast, currently producing The Bob Newhart Show.
One of the great historians, was it Henrik van Loon? I think it was, said when the show was on the air that this is the greatest piece of Americana that's being produced in the United States today. This show is real Americana. And it was. You know, now, for the last 12 years, I've been engaged in writing comedy shows for television. And I've seen a lot of comedy material, so I think I have some perspective on comedy talent and comedy quality. And I don't think there's ever been anything like Vic and Sade. And I don't say that every day's show was great, but the amount of innovative, original kind of comedy that came out of it, none of it was derivative that I know of. It was all the expression of a really unique personality, and that was Paul Reimer, a completely fresh, unique way of looking at the world. I'm just in awe of it, and I'm more and more in awe of it the more that I see of comedy as it's being produced today. Well, in going back to the University of Wisconsin and going over these thousands of scripts, I didn't find them dated in the least. They were as fresh and as wonderful now as they ever were, and they have that kind of timeless quality that real writing has. And I think they will live in some form or another. I'm delighted that those scripts are still available, and I think one of the greatest crimes of the century was the fact that the recordings were destroyed by Procter & Gamble. And I think that makes me burn every time I think of it. I think this was short-sighted, and it was absolutely unforgivable.
Bob Brown was a staff announcer at NBC in 1932. He was asked to announce a new family comedy that had recently gone on the air.
The show started when, I don't really remember, but it started with a little phrase, Welser. Well, I was the one that coined that phrase, because Paul wrote originally an opening as we approached the little house halfway up in the next block. It is, and he set the scene so that you knew exactly what's going to happen after you got in the house. But I always felt that there was an abrupt quality of coming in as we approach, and I wanted something that was perhaps as I don't know whether the word is bucolic, but I guess it is, as warm and rural Americanish as a phrase like Welser. And I went to Paul one day, and I said, Paul, would you mind if, when I open the show, instead of going into it cold, after I come out of the Crisco commercial, to pause a moment and then say, well, sir, as we approach, you know, I said it's a transitional. It's like a conjunction from the commercial to the show. And he said, no, it's fine. So I introduced that little phrase. It's my only claim to fame on Vic and Sade was that.
Vic and Sade was taken off the air in 1944. Later, an attempt was made to revive it. It was put into a new format, 1.5 hour in length. And many of the townspeople whose names were famous to listeners, but who had never been heard, were given voice. Chuck and Dottie Brainfeeble appeared, as did Pelter Unbleat and his imaginary brother, both parts played by Butler Mandeville. Roy Delfino was played by Forrest Lewis. And Dwight 26ler, who always went around with his mouth full of shingle nails, was played by Cliff Subir, who also played Mr. Gumpox, the garbage man. Rush's friend, Bluetooth Johnson, was played by Leonard Smith. Another actor who played several parts in that short series was Johnny Coons, who later became known as Uncle Johnny on Chicago television.
One of the highlights of my career was the opportunity to work on Vic and Sade. I thought that was one of the greatest shows that was ever on the air. Paul Reimer, who wrote that show, was a genius. And Paul was such a wonderful man and had the ability of being able to write for a specific person once he heard him. Of course, they didn't bring the characters to life until later in the middle 40s when they did a half-hour version. Actually, they did a 15-minute version first for Procter & Gamble, where they brought characters like L.J. Gerdner and Mervyn S. Sprawl and Smelly Clark and Orville Weenie and Harry Dean and Richigan Fishigan from Sichigan, Michigan, and Roy Delfino, who could rub his bare feet together and produce a clear blue flame and light his cigar. And they had all these characters that were given voice.
L.J. Gertner was a city water inspector. Yes, Mr. Gook. And I'll see you at about noon tomorrow morning. Thank you very much.
And then there was Mervyn S. Sprawl.
Yes, my name is Mervyn S. Sprawl. My daughter brought me over here to get some of peanuts with a chocolate smeared on the outsides. My shawl's slipping. I was born in Pittsburgh. Yes, Indianapolis. I was born in Indianapolis.
Every city they mentioned, he was born there. And then there was Orville Weenie, who was one of Rush's pals.
I live just down the street here. Yeah, my name is Orville Weenie. Hi, Rush. Oh, yeah, about 15 or 20 minutes, I'd suspect. All right. Bye, Mr. Gook, Miss Gook.
And then there was Smelly Clark, who was another friend of Rush's, and he sounded, if I can remember, it's been a long time.
Hi, Rush. Yeah, it's Smelly. Okay, you gonna play baseball this afternoon? All right. Is Uncle Fletcher gonna be there? Yeah. Well, I thought maybe he could be the umpire. Yeah, okay.
And then there was Harry Dean, Harry Dean just came in and out once in a while, and he was sort of a brush.
Hi, Mr. Gook. It's Harry Dean. Yeah. Mm-hmm. All right, we can handle that for you. All right. Yes, sir.
But for one reason or another, Vic and Sage just didn't seem the same in the new format.
I don't really think they gained anything by bringing these characters to life. Because, to all intents and purposes, you thought they did talk. You heard so much about them that you never realized they didn't talk until they started talking.
Yes, but it wasn't successful, and neither was the television show successful. It was a bold attempt, but it didn't... On the television show, well, there were two versions of that. One, they tried to create the characters. But it didn't last long. It wasn't the original cast either, as I remember.
I think Paul, when he first conceived the show and started writing it, he wrote it with three characters only for several reasons. One was that it was economical. It saved the network a lot of money. It was a sustaining show, and we only stayed on for 2.5 years sustaining because it was such a cheap show to do. I got $27.50 a week, and Bernadine and Van, I think, got $35 or something like that. And so the economics were part of the reason why Paul made it a three-character show. But I think there was also an artistic reason why, and it was because he was creating characters that really did not exist in life as they were portrayed. They were a little bit bigger than life. They were a little more outrageous than life. They were really caricatures in some way, and there is no human voice in the world that could exactly duplicate these characters, represent these characters. And Paul made these characters do the most outrageous things, and he could because you never actually heard them. They were only told about, so the imagination filled in the rest of it. It was radio going one better on itself. You not only imagined what was being said, you imagine things that were not being said. You imagine people that weren't heard. So that Paul did a unique thing there. He created a whole town of people that were never actually heard. And yet the audience knew these people as intimately as they knew the ones that spoke. We would get laughs on things. We would say about something that tell about something that some character did. And we would get a laugh because people say, that's just like him. That's just like him. And they had never heard that guy. But the characters were so completely drawn just from references. And we would get laughs on people's phone calls, one-sided phone calls, where you only imagined what the other person said. And Paul's one-sided phone calls were so skillful. The things that were said by the characters on mic were so perfect that you imagined what the other person said, and it was always in character, in this outrageous character.
And I remember I had a sister living in Chicago at the time, when she loved Beckinsale, and we talked nearly every day on the phone. One time, I was on the show alone. Paul did that. He had me on the telephone talking to Ruthie Stembottom. They just gab, lady talk, you know. The wash rag sale at Yamilton's and the brick mush man and the letter she just got from her niece Yuntsi, who played the piano with, she got to where she could run her fingernail down, up and down the black keys, you know, and all that. And Walter's kneecap had let up considerable on the twinges, and she had to tell Ruthie all those important things that had happened. So when I talked to my sister that day, I said, well, how'd you like the show today? And she said, I loved it. I just loved it. And I said, who'd you like best? She said, what do you mean? You all fit together so well. Well, I said, now, I'm not asking for a compliment here. I just want to, you know, some days one sort of has the lead and the rest is fill in. Now, which one stood out to you? Oh, she said, dear, I don't know. I said, Lenore, there was nobody on the show but me today. She said, oh, no, that's not true. I don't believe it. I said, you did hear it. Did you hear the whole thing? I heard the whole thing. I never miss it.
But no one could. They tried to bring it back with different people, and it was not successful because they couldn't. There's no way they could simulate these people. They were so firmly entrenched in the American minds that people would not accept it, I'm sure. And it was not the same thing.
Well, I think here's a prime example of trying to convert into reality the things that are so much better left to the imagination. I know Amos and Andy tried to do it when they tried to cast the movie, the TV series of Amos and Andy, and while I think some of the characters were wonderful, certainly Andy was in the TV series, and the Kingfish and Madam Queen, Amos never came across. I never felt that Amos had any character, because I had my own image of Amos, and I had my own image of Vic and Satan Rush. Even though I knew the people, I had another on-the-air image of Vic and Sade, which is a totally different thing. Also, I had images of what Mr. Gumpox and the other people looked like, and when I heard somebody cast and reading as Mr. Gumpox, no, I'm sorry, he never sounded like that to me, and I can't believe him. They never appeared, and you didn't care if they had never appeared, because I can see Robert and Slobbert Hinks right now, and all those people, they were real. Bluetooth Johnson was real to me. Ruthie was real to me. All the people that the people in the story were real.
They used to have a live audience for the evening one, the half-hour version. And I went down there once or twice. But I never liked it. Maybe it's because I was seeing it, not just listening. But I think the bringing in of other characters didn't help it. Brimer couldn't write to that. He really wrote for that 10 minutes. He knew how to handle that kind of a time frame, I think. I don't think, you see, when it went to a half an hour, he had to introduce other characters and so on, and I don't really think that was his game.
That last voice was Franklin McMahon, the noted Chicago artist, who was a friend of Paul Reimer and a devoted Vic and Sade fan. At a meeting of the Art Directors Society of St. Louis, McMahon spoke of Vic and Sade.
Julius Williams, he listened. He remembers the tiny petite pheasant feather tea shop. He said, and Ruthie Stenbottom used to go to the Hamiltons to buy wash rags, and on the way back they'd stop off at the tiny petite pheasant feather tea shop, and that's what Williams remembers the most about it. The central fact of Vic's life was that he was exalted Big Dipper in the Drowsy Venus chapter of the Sacred Stars of the Milky Way, and he was a member of the All-Star Marching Team. This marching team had chapters from Dismal Seepage, Ohio to East Brain, Oregon. But the trouble is they could never get together, so they'd march separately in each town. He had a friend in Lester, Nebraska, Y.Y. Flurch, and Y.Y. Flurch was forever getting hit with fast passenger trains, and Vic would get a wire from J.J. Stunbolt, who was Y.Y. Flurch's friend, that he'd been hit by a fast passenger train. This would happen every couple of months. Another the guy who lived in Vic's town and was a member of the lodge was Richigan Fishigan from Sishigan, Michigan. Uncle Fletcher had a friend who was an armed guard at the Ohio State Home for the Tall. Well, in the program, the Bright Kentucky Hotel was by the railroad track. And when the fast trains came through from Chicago to St. Louis, the hotel would shake. And Gumpot the garbage man lived in this hotel. And when the trains would go by, his bed would shake and it'd move across the room. So they put a longer train on between Chicago and St. Louis. And his bed moved right across the room and out down the hall. There's one circumstance in which he waves bon voyage, you know, to another guy who's coming by from the other way.
We've heard a sample of the voices of the people Foster was able to contact for our conversational tour. We'll continue after a 5-second pause for station identification.
You're tuned to Radio in the American Tradition, 88.5 FM, WAMU, Washington.
Before going on, let's take a few moments to hear again what Vic and Sade was really like. Let's go back to March 12, 1942.
Get ready to smile again with Radio's Home Folks, Vic and Sade, written by Paul Reiner.
Well, sir, it's a minute or two past 12 o'clock as we enter the small house halfway up in the next block now. And here in the kitchen, we find Mrs. Victor Gook and her son, Mr. Rush Gook. The table is set for the noonday meal, and our friends are hovering beside the gas stove, chatting idly. Listen.
Plain Brain Whooper up at school claims he's related to your friends Edith and Raleigh, Ma.
Aw.
His locker's right next to mine in the gymnasium, and we were sitting on the bench this morning, lacing up our shoes, and just to make talk, I mentioned my mother had very dear friends in Kentucky with the same name as his.
And he said he was related?
Yeah. But I'm pretty sure it was just axle grease and peach butter. He talked too glib, see?
Edith
and Raleigh Whooper, he says, why, bless your heart, chum, the family connection is terrible close. My Aunt Eleanor married a man named Borchardt, and they had two children, Roy and Touchy. I've all...
Listen.
Huh?
Yes?
That's the high horse to hold.
Well, coming in the front door these days, aren't we?
Probably walked up Virginia Avenue with Steve Chestbutter and absentmindedly walked up on the porch.
I bet my wife's furious because I used the front door. Is my wife furious because I used the front door?
We do have some rules and regulations.
I can explain. Well, Rush, I find you home.
Greetings, guys.
No, but about using the front door, it seems to me, as long as we agree we ought to come in the back, it isn't fair for one party to do the one thing and the other...
That's pity. Not another word, Diddy.
Hmm.
You're very angry now, I know, but in just a second you're going to be angrier still.
Why?
Because I'm not eating dinner here this noon.
Oh?
I'm sorry and sick with regret and proffer 1,000 apologies, but it's just one of those things. Hmm. The only reason I come home was to get a clean shirt. Rush, trot up and get Papa a clean shirt. A white one.
Okay.
Scoot, my dear.
I want to hear why you're not eating with us.
Because I'm dining with business associates at the little tiny petite pheasant feather tea shoppy.
Oh.
Now, Scoot.
Okay.
You might also bring down with you my blue necktie with the white dot.
All right.
I got lovely stuff fixed for you.
Yes, and it smells mighty, mighty good.
You might at least have telephoned or something.
I couldn't. I didn't know. This all come up on the spur of the moment. Oh, well, that's the penalty of being a cog in the wheel of big business. A man must adjust himself to circumstances. A man must be prepared to alter the pattern of his regimen at any second.
Gonna eat at the little tiny feather to weather, huh?
The little tiny petite pheasant feather tea shoppy.
Who all? Go on.
An extremely illustrious group. Your poor husband, I fear, will be badly overshadowed.
Mr. Buller in town?
Mr. Buller's in town, and guess who else is in town?
Who?
Mr. Gus Fuss. The brilliant kitchenware executive from Dubuque, Iowa.
Oh?
Those two luminaries are going to dinner. The chief himself, Mr. Rubish, is going to dinner. And your wretched husband makes a fortune.
Say, you are eating with the hotshot blue blood.
Of course, I'm awful darn sorry to throw a wrench in your household machinery.
Oh, well. Well, how'd they happen to pick out the little shoppy-to-woppy?
Buller's idea.
Big, enormous dignitaries like Mr. Rubus generally eat at the Butler House Hotel, don't they?
Yeah, the little tiny cheap pheasant feather tea shop he was Buller's notion. He's been there before, you know, and he likes it.
You got two blue neckties with white spots, guy. I brought down the one that looked the newest.
Yes, and you used your head. You are a good boy. One of these days, it is extremely unlikely that I give you half a dollar.
Okay.
I will now change my shirt.
Fine.
You people needn't mind me. Sit down and eat your dinner.
Won't be ready for a few minutes yet.
Uh-huh.
Your father's dining with big important muckety-mucks this noon.
Oh? Mr. Rubish, Mr. Buller, and Mr. Gus Fuss of Dubuque, Iowa.
Well,
I trust you're proud of your father?
Sure.
It astonishes me why they should pick out that little tiny tea shoppy to floppy.
Mr. Buller admires their home cooking and the generous serving. He was greatly pleased with both the service and the cuisine when he was there before.
Oh, it's such a dinky establishment.
It's modest, yes.
What's the matter?
Ready?
You suddenly stopped, unbuttoning your shirt, and stared off into space.
Oh, did you that?
Don, I was just telling Mommy about Rain Brain Vooper up at school.
Oh,
yes. Yes, it seems Rain Brain Vooper said...
Yeah.
You want to hear something funny?
Sure.
Your mention in the little tiny petite pheasant feather tea shop, he reminded me.
Oh?
Kind of a ridiculous situation.
Huh?
It might amuse you and it might not. It amuses me.
So what is it?
Mr. Buller was determined to take us three guys to the little tiny petite pheasant feather tea shop.
Uh-huh.
So he made arrangements with Mrs. Grice, the proprietor.
Hmm.
Now comes the funny part.
Yes? Well, what's the funny part?
Mrs. Grice is only three tables in her restaurant.
Yes, I know.
Well, as luck would have it, two of these tables had already been reserved before Mr. Buller showed up.
Well?
Some family party or other reserved these two tables and made arrangements with Mrs. Grice to seat 11 persons.
11 persons at two tables?
Exactly. Necessitates some crowding.
Yes, I'd imagine.
Necessitates some crowding.
How does this affect you and Mr. Rubish and Mr. Buller and Mr. Fuss?
Yeah, how does it?
Well, as a matter of fact, I personally am the one affected.
Oh.
Here comes the funny part.
Uh-huh.
Sit down and enjoy your dinner, you people.
It's not ready.
Oh. How's this shirt look?
All right.
What?
What's the funny part?
Funny part. Sure, the funny part.
Oh.
Well, on account of this half-wit family party cluttering up the tea shoppy, our table has to be shoved against the wall. And no matter how the three tables are placed, our table will only seat three persons.
Somebody has to stand up and eat?
No.
You have to stand up and eat?
Nobody has to stand up and eat. Everybody gets to sit down.
Uh-huh.
However, a makeshift arrangement did have to be devised.
And you're the goat.
What?
I can tell by your actions and the expression on your face you've been rung in on something and feel foolish about it.
Oh, now, hey.
What makeshift arrangement was devised?
Well, it worked out very simply. Our table is to be shoved up against the wall and...
You're going to eat underneath?
Beg pardon?
You're going to eat underneath the table?
I'm afraid you're a capricious boy, Rush.
Mm-hmm.
Our table is to be shoved up against the wall, Dave.
Yes.
And here we have a bit of ingenuity.
Oh?
A bit of clever ingenuity as provided by Gus Fuss.
What's that?
Well, instead of shoving our table up against the wall, see?
Yes.
It's to be shoved up against a window.
You're going to eat outdoors?
What?
You're going to go outside the window?
Oh, no, one at a time, please. Yes, Dave.
You're going to stand outside the window and eat?
I'm not going to stand anywhere and eat.
Well, explain what you're talking about, then.
A ladder will be provided.
A step ladder?
Yes, with a sofa pillow on it.
And you're going to sit on that ladder outside the building?
The table will be flush with the windowsill. The step ladder will also be flush with the windowsill. I will be outside the tea shoppy. The other three fellows will be inside the tea shoppy. What difference does it make? We'll be four fellas sitting around a table eating our dinner, won't we?
Oh, no, Vic.
I consider it a very clever strategy.
The stuff you get yourself into.
I had sort of a halfway hunch you'd view the matter in a peculiar light.
The people going past on the street.
What about them?
Aren't they apt to view the matter in a peculiar light also? Here's a man sitting on a stepladder outside a restaurant, poking his head through the window.
Oh, heck, Sade.
Well, why does it always have to be you that holds the dirty end of the stick?
Would you have the big boss, Mr. Rubish, sitting on a stepladder eating through a window?
I wouldn't have anybody doing it.
Would you have Mr. Buller doing it?
I wouldn't have anybody doing it.
Would you have Gus Fuss, the smart executive from Dubuque, doing it?
I wouldn't have anybody doing it.
I know what you think. You think I'm being placed in a ridiculous position.
Well, aren't you?
No, I'm being a good fella and adjusting myself to circumstances. Why, I'm honored in the first place even to be invited to eat with three brilliant...
Telephone's ringing. Telephone's ringing.
I'll get it. You people sit down and have dinner.
Maybe we better, Willie.
Okay.
Hello? Oh, yes, Mr. Rubish. Oh? Yeah, that's right. Why, not at all, Mr. Rubish. No, not a bit of it. Why, it'll be fun. Sure. Forget it. No, not at all. Yes, and I'll see you there in just a few minutes. Okay, Chief. You bet. Goodbye. You know who that was?
Mr. Rubish.
Yes, and he telephoned to say that he bet I wouldn't want to sit on any stepladder outside of any restaurant. And wouldn't blame me if I said the heck with it and announced I think Gus Fuss is a lame brain.
Oh.
He's a grand old boss.
Yeah. Well, are you going to do it? Are you going to perch yourself on the stepladder outside the little tiny Dewiney tea shop?
Of course I'm going to do it. I'm going to like doing it.
Mm.
Sure.
Carl.
What?
I just glanced out the window.
Well?
It's raining. Raining pretty brisk.
Why, so it is.
Rush.
Yes?
Go upstairs.
Yes?
Get me an umbrella.
During the first 8 years or so, Vic and Sade consisted of only three characters: Vic, Sade, and the boy, Rush. Around 1940, a new character made his appearance, Sade's amiable Uncle Fletcher. As we got to know Uncle Fletcher, we found that his life consisted mainly of making excitement out of the rather humdrum events that transpired, and building those events into an imposing structure of vast importance. For example, when his landlady planned to get married, Uncle Fletcher took complete charge. He even planned to go on the honeymoon.
Is that Vic?
Yeah, well, I'm
even taking my landlady and her bridegroom's honeymoon for him. After the wedding, I'm traveling to Champaign, Urbana, Clinton, Decatur, Springfield, and Iliopolis. I'm traveling by myself. My landlady and her numbskull bridegroom are staying home. Miss Keller don't want to leave her 100 chickens, and both her and Feedburn get car sick and dizzy when they ride on the train. So they're going to stay home, and I'm going to take their lame brain honeymoon for them.
Sometimes Uncle Fletcher's responsibilities seem to take on overwhelming proportions.
Do I have the responsibility for this wedding on my shoulders, or don't I have the responsibility for this wedding on my shoulders?
Well, as far as the honeymoon is concerned, you certainly have the responsibility.
And all the rest of the nitwit, numbskull, fathead details.
Well, you guess...
Who's hiring the lame brain preacher? I'm hiring the lame brain preacher. Who has to fret and stew and worry and squirm figuring out wedding presents and trash? I do.
Well, I...
Who tramped all the way out to the Chicago and Alton Railroad yards tonight after supper, risking their life dodging switch engines to get to the Bright Kentucky Hotel to find Michigan Fishigan from Fishigan, Michigan? I did. I tell you, they're running me ragged.
Who?
Everybody and their nitwit brother. I haven't got a numbskull second to call my own. I'm on the run from morning till night. No, it wouldn't surprise me none if I got caught up in the floodgates of activity and was destroyed against the rocks.
What rocks?
Yes, thunder. I'm a man, not a machine.
I expect you're referring to the wedding?
I'm referring to Leota Keller getting married to Harry Feedburn.
Oh.
I wouldn't tell this to everybody. And Vic and Sadie, honey, I hope you won't even go any further. But I'm telling you right out frank and candid that I will never, as long as I live, undertake a project of this nature again.
It's running me ragged. I've got to be careful.
Yes, sir. You'll get caught up in the frenzied floodgates of activity and be destroyed against the rocks. Exactly.
It's been an enormous undertaking. I'd never tackle it again in 1,000 years. Why, I no more than get 30 or 40 details arranged and some new problem arises. It's no child's play, I can tell you.
Gee, no.
But I plan to stick with her and turn in as neat a job on it as is humanly possible. No, I haven't just decided on a date for the wedding yet.
Mm-hmm.
I may make it 2 weeks from today. I may make it 2 weeks from tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
I'll cipher it out.
Mm-hmm.
I'll cipher it out.
Yeah, sure you will.
What kind of a person was Uncle Fletcher in the eyes of the man who played the part?
Well, I could picture Uncle Fletcher as the type of man that if he worked, he rode a bicycle to work, and he always used one of those clamps around his pants legs to keep his pants from getting caught in the sprocket. And when he got dressed up on Sunday, he looked uncomfortable with a stiff, starched collar and a tie that somebody had given to him for Christmas 15 years ago. If he wore a hat, it would be uncomfortable, but it would be not a speck of dust or dirt on it, but it would leave a red rim around his head when he took his hat off. And he wore garters, which were very uncomfortable. And his type of fellow, too, would probably not only wear a belt, but a pair of suspenders along with it. He always, older people sometimes, all they can talk about is the disastrous things that happen. What happened to the friends of theirs? And you get to talking to them, the most depressing conversations. This person actually maybe got hit by a fast passenger train or some awful thing happened to them. You know what I mean? And they just say it as if they enjoyed telling about it. And it was just a matter of conversation. They didn't think anything of it. Well, that's Uncle Fletcher, too. Married a woman 21 years old, later died. Fell off a five-story building and lived to tell it, and this was remarkable to him. And they have a way of making important and least important things in their conversation. And they have told these stories numerous times, and they get bigger to them as they keep telling them about some guy that got on a train and went to Indiana and got off the train, began to cry, got back on the train, went home. This was something to remember. This man was famous, Uncle Fletcher. And the hyena grease, the fact that somebody had concocted that, made it in his kitchen, why, it was the finest thing in the world that ever happened. everyone has in their family, in their circle of family relationships, at least one person who is just a little bit out, way out. And they would defend them to the death if anybody ridiculed them or made fun of them or even made a sly remark about them. Maybe it's an uncle, maybe it's a grandparent or a distant cousin. But Bickensade, and particularly the characterization of Uncle Fletcher, was a way-out relationship such as this. And I can remember Sade used to get very, very put out with Vic and Rush when they poked a little fun at Uncle Fletcher, because she loved him and she felt almost a religious obligation to stand up for him. But the listener can visualize Uncle Fletcher, can put their own Uncle Fletcher in Uncle Fletcher's place and laugh. Be free to laugh at him. And this was my way, too, of poking a little fun at them.
But maybe we're getting a little bit ahead of ourselves here. Let's go back to the very beginning of Vic and Sade. Certainly in the case of Vic and Sade, the beginning was the year 1932 when I came up from Cincinnati, where I'd been chief announcer for WLW, and joined the NBC announcing staff in Chicago. Paul Reimer at that time was a staff continuity writer. I don't think there was a trade lower than that. You wrote things like, and the next number to be played by the Jolly Blue Blazers will be Japanese Sandman. Paul ground this out by the hour, and I think he was pretty well sick of it at the time that I came there. And he was also writing a horrible dramatic effort called The Keystone Chronicle. In 1932, there was a lot of metamorphosis going on
NBC. A lot of soap operas were being put together. Chicago was evolving the 15-minute, five-week, what they called strip shows in those days. Suddenly, Dancer Fitzgerald and Sample, the agency in Chicago, suddenly realized that they had a lion by the tail and something ought to work here, and they sold the idea to Procter & Gamble, and Procter & Gamble immediately sensed that they could reach the American housewife with these soap operas. Those things all began to assume great importance in the daily lives of the American housewife. I don't think I'd been on Bick and Sade if it hadn't been for Charlie Lyon, a very good friend of mine who is now one of the producers of Truth or Consequences in Hollywood. Charlie had been the announcer on the initial efforts of Bick and Sade, sponsored, I think, by Jelky's Margarine. Well, Charlie either came up with a conflict of interest in clients. He couldn't work because he was working for somebody else that made butter or something. And anyway, suddenly up came Bick and Sade for grabs, and the program manager said, it's in your scheduled time during the day. Would you like to announce it? And I said, what is it? And he said, I don't know. It's a little family situation comedy. And I said, yes, I'd be delighted to do it. So I went in and I met Billy Idelson, who then was a very young, callow kid. I remember he wore a felt cap, which was an old hat, the crown cut with sort of a serrated edges and then turned up, and all it lacked to be a beanie was the propeller on top. I guess he was 8 or 9 years old. I don't think he was any... Was he 11? He looked 8 or 9. Byrne had just finished long runs in Empire Builders and Campana's First Nighter and things of that nature, had done beautifully, and she was going to try a fling at this new creation called a soap opera. And Art Van Bershot, who was Art Van Harvey, who played Vic, came in. I think he was a space salesman for the Swine Breeders Gazette and an amateur actor of parts. So that you had three of the strangest careers. Billy, who had done little or no drama. Vic, who had done some drama. Byrne, who had done a great deal of drama and was a very fine, balanced actress. A writer who was one of the strangest people I think I ever met.
Well, I don't like to talk about the beginning because it's something that grew. And I feel that I'm making it up. I feel that I'm just making up a story because I know now that it was a successful show, but I didn't in the beginning. If I said I thought it was great, I know I'd be lying. I had no way of knowing how good it was. I wasn't that perceptive. And if I say I hated it, I would also be lying. I know I didn't dislike it, because I did the job and I didn't do any shows that I didn't like. I only casually knew Paul Reimer, and I didn't know his writing. And I imagine the first few scripts are nothing like the scripts we know now and remember.
I had done a couple of shows as a kid. One was Gasoline Alley on WGN, and then a couple of others, and I hated radio acting. I didn't feel I was good, and I announced to my family that I no longer would do any of this. I wanted to play and so forth. And one day I came home and my mother said that she'd accepted a call for me to do a show on NBC called Bick and Sade, which I'd never heard of. It'd only been on a few days. And I went into a screaming tantrum saying I refused to do it, but she said, well, it's only for 4 days. They said the part would only be in for 4 days. And so that kind of mollified me. I said, okay, I'll do it for 4 days, and that's it.
Billy was one of the most beautifully brought up young men I've ever known. Children. And if he felt that way, he wouldn't show it. We got a smile and warmth and everything, because we were people and he was people. So that we wouldn't have known.
And I went down there and met the people and read the script, and we rehearsed this show in the lobby, the 19th floor lobby. It was early in the morning, and in the studio that we were going to use, there was a show going on, so we couldn't rehearse in there. So we read, Van and Byrne and I sat on benches, the reception benches in the 19th floor lobby, and Clarence Menser, who was a program director of NBC, was our director, and he sat at the reception desk. But just reading this script, I knew this was an entirely different thing than anything I'd ever done before, and I was really confused because I liked it.
Yeah, but Billy is perceptive. Now, he's a writer himself and a producer by now, and I'm not at all surprised that Billy would have appreciated it from the start. Really, that doesn't surprise me. As young as he was.
I went in and did the show. It was the first show I only said one word on, hello. And I came down and did the second show, and that was a kind of a big emotional script. Rush was an adopted son. He was Sade's sister's boy, and this was during the Depression, and they had taken the boy because his sister couldn't afford to keep him anymore. And there was an emotional scene where he was homesick and wanted to go home, and Vic talks to him, and it was probably the most demanding role I'd ever had as a child actor, and I did it well because I was really in it. It was part of me. A whole different thing happened to me then. I think in that moment I became an actor. And I was sorry that I was only going to be in it 4 days. Well, it turned out I was in it for 12 years.
I got a call to come down for an audition. I went up to the audition and there were three of us. Cliffy Subir, who was famous for his work in the old Wiener Minstrels, Little Cliffy and Pussin. And Sid Elstrom, very fine character actor, and I. We were the ones going to do the audition. Well, I read the part, and I just got the feeling that here was something that I liked to do. That it just kind of, I felt good in it.
I don't know if anyone else talked about the first time we heard Clarence Hartzell. Well, that was an amazing thing. Because, you know, the reason we brought Uncle Fletcher in was because Van was sick with heart trouble, and we had to bring in this other character as insurance. And an actor by the name of Sidney Elstrom, who was a very well-known character actor in Chicago, was thought to be the perfect Clarence Hartzell. Would be the perfect Uncle Fletcher, excuse me. And everybody assumed that Sidney would play the part of Uncle Fletcher, and we had an audition of two or three other people just as a matter of form, but automatically we felt Sidney Elstrom was going to be Uncle Fletcher. I think of Clarence so completely as Uncle Fletcher that the two names are interchangeable. But anyway, we heard several people, and then Clarence came in to read, and none of us had ever seen him or heard of him before. Bernadine and I were reading with the actors that came in to read for Uncle Fletcher because Van was in the hospital. So it was just Bernadine and I sitting at a table, and then there was a standing mic for the actors that came in to read for Uncle Fletcher. Well, Clarence came in, and we'd heard several other people, and they sounded okay. Clarence read the first line, and Bernadine and I literally fell off the chair. We looked at each other, and it was just so perfect and so funny that we couldn't read anymore. We stopped reading, and we just looked at him, and it was just like this man had come from Mars, and was our conception of Clarence Hartzell. It hit us both at the same time, our conception of Uncle Fletcher.
So after I got through, I thought, well, these two fellas have been here at NBC longer than I have. I was just a young squirt and upstart. They were certainly more experienced character actors than I was. So I put it out of my mind. I thought, well, here's another audition. I'm glad I was called. I was complimented that I would be called for such an important show. I just put it out of my mind. They said, wait outside for a while. So I went out in the lobby and waited. Pretty soon, the director came out and said, would you come in the studio again? So I went in, and they told me that I got the part.
The producer said, well, yeah, he was funny, but he's not the actor that Sidney Ahlstrom is, and so forth. And we fought for Clarence because nobody had ever heard of him before. And we said there can't be anybody else than him. We insisted on having Clarence as Uncle Fletcher. And that's how he happened to get the job.
This is a tribute to Vic and Sade, a remembrance of something unique in old daytime radio. We've been hearing the voices of the Vic and Sade players and a few episodes from the show itself. This tribute, produced by Jack Foster and distributed without charge to radio stations everywhere, is being presented in two parts. This is the conclusion of part one. Now, here's today's version of the old-time radio announcer to tell you when to listen for the second part.